Worst Thing. I'm your host, Josh Walewa. I want to take a moment just to say thank you to all the listeners who followed us from really around the world. We've had listeners from the United States, Europe, Asia, and Africa. In particular, Vietnam, France, Canada, Pakistan, Japan, Sweden, Nigeria, the UK, Cameroon, Germany, Bangladesh, Nepal, India. I wanted to let you know that I see you and I hear you, and I'm just glad that you're getting something out of this. I hope that you continue to listen to our show as we head towards season two, which will kick off in November. For now, we're going to have two best of episodes. We're going to have just some of the clips from season one, where we get to hear from some of our guests as they drop some amazing jewels of hope and inspiration. And then again, tune in for season two, which comes out in November. So two best of episodes, and we'll go to season two. I'd love to hear from those of folks who are following us around the United States. Of course, we have people in Arizona, California, New York, and so many other places. I'm just super touched and thrilled that you all are tuning in. So email us on the website, jw@bestworstthingpodcast.com, and I'd love to stay in touch with you. Until then, enjoy the episode. What's your leadership approach as you have such a huge portfolio underneath you and so many people who are underneath you? Kind of, you know, how do you manage realistically that number of people with that much responsibility? What do you do? What's the mindset you take into that work?
Yeah, well, I have an incredible team, you know, and it's not just me. And I rely on the folks that I work with every day to do their job and do it well. And so to me, it's a partnership. But my philosophy is I come to work every day trying to prove to those people that work for me why I am there. Like, my job is to prove to them my value. And so I begin every day trying to figure out, how am I going to bring value to my team? I don't view it as they need to bring value to me to keep their job, you know, because you got to lead by example. So as long as every day I'm providing value, and they see that I'm dialed in and I want them to be successful, then they're dialed in, they want to be successful, and hopefully they're emulating that down the line. And so if we're all just trying to every day bring it for the folks that are working for us, they see that sense of he's proving something to me that he's worthy of my time and my dedication. And from that, I think people just dig deeper and they bring more. You know, and so it's a lot, and you can get overwhelmed by it. And there are days and certainly recent days where it has been a tremendous amount of work. But everybody steps up, and if everybody does their part, then we're going to figure it out. And I think the last thing too is, you know, my environmental health and safety team, they're all scientists, you know, and so all I can bring to them is the logic and the company culture and help them help us make decisions where we need to. But they're the scientists. They're bringing the answers. They're bringing the data. And I need to trust them in that. And so for me, it's also about just trusting your folks and making sure that they feel trusted. But they also know that, hey, my expectation, you're going to make a mistake. And just know that I expect it and I'm okay with it. We just can't make the same mistakes over and over, right? So we're all humans. We're all trying to do the best we can. And I think that if you show that you're dedicated, they'll be dedicated to it. I'm just so thankful. You know, I'm just a happier person. You know, my outlook is different. The way I respond to things is totally different. There's this inner voice in my mind that will perk up. And it's there. I haven't shut it off. But when it perks up and that negativity comes in, I'm equipped to say, check the facts. What's actually happening? Mm-hmm. What did someone actually say to you? What is the situation? And, you know, I'm just so glad that, you know, loneliness, depression, feeling isolated, all those things are in my rearview mirror. I just know that they're not in other people's. Mm-hmm. And I can sometimes just see it. Like, you know, I'm sure other people feel this way, but you can hide it. You can try to hide it, but the cracks will be there. People will see it. And, you know, in sharing this story, I truly hope that other people, other men out there, proud people who just like, I'm not going to go do that. That's not what men do. Well, this guy, this man, yeah, he sees a therapist. This man, you know, if I want to cry, I'll cry, you know, and it makes me, I think it makes me a better friend, makes me a better husband, makes me a better father. You know, I want to show my son that emotions are okay. It's okay to have feelings and it's okay to talk about it.
My mother was a civil rights activist also, and we had very many interesting friends in our family, and we stood up for many, many different rights, not just of the differently abled, as my mother would have called them, but for all people. And I learned at a very young age that there was no difference between me and anyone else other than my white privilege. We weren't rich, but I had white privilege. And I was a woman before women were really being treated as equals. Still, that's, we've got a long way to go. So I have some empathy, but I could not walk in the experience of somebody who was African-American or Hispanic or any other race or religion that, or race predominantly. And I, you know, wanted to learn from everybody else. So that was another thing, is when you learn from other people, when you ask questions and share, sometimes that question can say, what do you want to know that for? That's none of your business. But other times it's one of those things that breaks down the door that makes us friends, that makes us know each other, our vulnerabilities and the things that we have in common. And so I have amazing lifelong friends that are didn't look like me, didn't come from my background, but we found common ground. And I wish that for everyone. I feel so fortunate that I grew up in a family that valued diversity, but also that I went to school with so many different people, and I appreciate it. I grew up in Miami. It wasn't integrated when I first went to school, but we had many, early in my school years, the Cuban refugees were coming to Miami. So that was its own challenge. And then when the schools became much more integrated, we lived right near a neighborhood that was African American. And so they all came, we all came to school together. And I don't even remember that it was any kind of a, it was just fun and great. And we were cheerleaders and sports players and debaters. And we it was a very unique school. I mean, the neighborhood, the school that came with us was also middle-class black families, and they came to our school, and but I didn't ask the question of my black friends, like, what else could I do? What's missing for you? And as adults, when we got back together at our 10-year reunions, every 10 years or so, I finally had the nerve to ask the question, and I learned a lot. And I wish I could go back to those years and do some things a little bit differently, but they had a huge impact on me. And we had a good relationship, but it could have been better had I known enough to ask some different questions. When I was just in kindergarten, they changed the age that you started first grade. So I had to go to kindergarten twice. And really, you didn't even know to need to go to kindergarten then. But I was really sad. I thought that was like the end of the earth. I remember like crying, you know, and just couldn't sleep at night. And my teacher, who I had the same teacher, she made me her assistant in her classroom, and she made me like the leader of the class. And that has its own challenges when you're 5 and 6 years old. But that helped me see that it wasn't such a bad thing, you know, to have to, I wasn't failing. I was actually succeeding. And my first grade teacher took it to a whole nother level because she taught us about mistakes by giving us a reward every Friday, her pencil that she graded our papers with, her red pencil. So I learned that you can make mistakes and be rewarded. Because mistake, as long as you know you made one, is a good thing. But I think I've always learned from them, and it's a hard one to think about. But I would say that many times I was turned down for something I thought I deserved. But when I got to what I thought, it was the next step was better. So I remember when I thought I was ready to be the president of a May department stores division, and two other men were picked before me, and they weren't nearly as good as I was, I thought. And I kind of in my head said, oh, you know, it's just because they're men and all that. And then the opportunity to be the president of Payless Shoe Source came along, which was the biggest division of the Bay Company. I loved shoes. I loved shoes. It was one thing I could buy and I didn't have to fix it because I could just put them on and walk out and wearing a whole new pair of shoes. So for me, shoes was a really big deal. And I got to learn from the founders of the company when we bought the company, I was involved in the acquisition team. And I got to learn from them. So it was like kind of going into the family business in a way. And when it was time to, and then 4 years later, the May Company decided to sell the company after I was the president of the company. They decided to spin it off as a separate company. And it gave me the chance to go into, to leave and start my own business. And because I did not want to really stay in Topeka, Kansas, no offense to Topeka, Kansas, but I wanted to come back to St. Louis. I wanted to do, and it dawned on me that I didn't have to go to work for somebody else. I could go start my own business. I had the wherewithal, the financial wherewithal, and I had the experience now. And I never thought about it before. And so I decided I was going to do something for children. But it was that, you know, that it wasn't like so much as it was a failure, as much as it was not a success. When the May Company decided to sell the company, it, I felt it like a failure. Like, you know, the May Company's not going to take this business forward. So, you know, that was like, I took it very personally, but I turned it into something really positive for me. And I, you know, it was just like a couple of days of feeling kind of depressed about it. And then I said, let me just take this money and go do something good with it. And I invested in my own business because most people thought, well, when I finally decided about the about Build-A-Bear, people thought I was crazy. Not kids, but adults. And I think that we had one big mistake when I was in Build-A-Bear. So you thought there was only one, but there's many. We had really early in our business, like maybe a month into it, our warehouse in North County, the roof collapsed on top of all of our merchandise that we'd bought. We were only a couple weeks into the business. And I realized I hadn't bought enough insurance. But fortunately, my vendors were so excited. The people that were making the product, they said, don't worry about it. Pay us when you can. Just tell us what you need and we'll ship it back to you. And we only had one store so they could make it in their back sample room in China and get it back to us. And then my first investor, he said, don't worry about it. We'll put more money in if you need it. But our business got so good really fast that we didn't really need that. And so that bad experience of that happening made me look at what we were selling and what we weren't selling, because I had to buy the stuff we were selling. And I realized there were some things we weren't selling. And I wouldn't have looked at it probably till after Christmas because we were so busy. So we sold out of all the bad stuff too, because we didn't have any good stuff left. We sold out of the bad stuff and then the good stuff came in again. So that was a lesson also in number one, make sure you have enough insurance. But the insurance company didn't pay us for 5 years anyway. But also that, you know, just pick yourself up, dust yourself off, get going. Because what are you going to do if you sit there and go, you know, wring your hands about the warehouse? You're not going to have a business. And I just started. I could have just closed in a month. It would have been so embarrassing and so scary. And how would I have paid all my, you know, my debts? And I had a 10-year lease at the Galleria. And so there was no choice. I don't see things like it. What a disaster that is. I say, okay, what can I learn from this? And same things happened during COVID. I have used this time to really thrive. I've used this time to attend meetings I never would have attended because I can, because I don't have to get in my car and go. I can tune in. And I've learned so much that I wouldn't have known. And then, of course, we've had all of this civic unrest that has also taught me a lot, because I've listened to a lot of young people on Zooms and in phone calls. And I've gotten to see a lot of really heartfelt, deep, open wounds teach me. And while I can't have lived that experience, I can listen. And it has been that, you know, when people ask me how you are, I say, I'm actually thriving. I've learned so much. Yes. And I don't mean it in any disrespect to the bubble that I, you know, the people around me, or I live in a bubble, but I have felt very nurtured by learning in this time period. And I am a little bit hesitant, you know, I mean, when are we all going to go back to our office? When are we going to go back to work? Because I don't want to give up that learning, you know, that time to learn that we've had, that slower pace forced on us. But I don't want to be sick and I don't want anybody else to be sick. So let's get going, you know, is pretty much the story. So there's no one thing, at least not at my age. You cross many, many challenges, but you have to turn them into opportunities.
So if you can tell me about your dad a little bit more about his influence on you.
Yeah, absolutely. So my dad has this concept that he called the freedom train. And so he said, you know, each of us needs to be a conductor on the freedom train. And being a conductor means that you commit yourself once you've gotten your ticket punched, and he would call, you know, getting your PhD, your ticket. And so he says, once you get your ticket punched, then your role is to bring others aboard the freedom train so that they too can get their ticket punched, become conductors of their own freedom train and bring others aboard. And I really like the visual of a train because, you know, a train is always moving, right? And it can move in a bunch of different directions, but it's always moving forward somewhere. And then you've got somebody who is pulling passengers aboard at every stop along the way. And so my dad always said, you know, the mark of a good mentor is, you know, not only your commitment to investing in the next generation, but when your mentees actually surpass you. And in terms of, you know, stature, in terms of their career, in terms of, you know, what it is that they're able to do in their work that's significant. And so my dad passed away 3 years ago. And when we had his celebration of life service, which really was a celebration of just joy, and, you know, everybody, all his students came back, and people believe that my dad was single-handedly responsible for over 100 people, mostly people of color, mostly first-generation students getting their PhDs. And then imagine every single one of them has now become conductors on their own freedom train, and they're doing the same thing that my dad taught them to do.
So what's your approach to leadership in such complex organizations?
Well, I think those who have worked with me before would probably describe me as a leader who's collaborative, because I don't believe that leaders can make unilateral decisions without getting other people involved. Because as one of my mentors says to me over and over, people are committed to what they help to create. So certainly there are some instances where a leader has to get in there and make a decision, you know, in times of incredible challenge, in times when, you know, there's a critical incident blossoming on the campus and you need to step in there. But in regular times, I really think it's important to be collaborative, to get folks involved, particularly at universities, you know, where we're about shared governance. And so, you know, it's really important for me as I think about the future of DePauw to be able to invite into those conversations our faculty, our students, our alums, clearly our board, and others. So, you know, I think people would describe me as a collaborative leader. I also think it's important for a leader to lead with vision. And again, you know, vision is not something that I can unilaterally impose on an organization, but nobody wants to work for a leader who has no vision at all, right? And so I really like to try to articulate for people where it is I think we can go as an institution, where we can go as an organization, and then rally people around that vision and invite them to help me put some meat on the bones of that vision, as one might say. You know, I've already talked about the fact that, you know, in my family, you know, we really have a commitment to service and a commitment to paying our lives forward. So I hope people would see me as the kind of leader who's invested in the professional growth and development of the people who work with me and for me. I think that's really important as well. And I hope people see me as a leader who is honest and transparent and an effective communicator, because I think many times when leaders are not successful, it's not because they don't have great leadership skills. It's because people perceive them as not being able to effectively communicate whatever it is that their vision is, or effectively bring people along with them, or to be transparent in their decision making.
I got brought into this thing, ended up being a disaster, and when it happened, oh my God. I was devastated. Like, I mean, I just felt like such a fuck up, you know what I mean? That I left this other job to do this. I remember coming home and just breaking down in front of my current wife, Amanda, my wife, Amanda, breaking down. I just couldn't even control it. And she's like, what's the matter? What's the matter? And I explained to her what happened and that we're fucked. Yeah. You know what I mean? And she's, you know, you should do a podcast with her. She's had a pretty tough life, you know? So she's like, we'll get through it, you know? And she's a rock, nice. You know? And she's like, we'll get through it. And she's a little rock. And she's like, we'll get through it. And we did. But man, it was humbling, humiliating to people in the scene, having to explain yourself that this thing is failing, begging for jobs, you know, shopping at the 99-cent store, just being flat broke, you know what I mean, for food, for months and months, you know, and it was just, I was still so passionate about, like, you know, trying to stay in this industry. But man, that was the time that I second guessed it more than ever about just totally just pivoting away from it and just doing something totally different and just becoming a regular person and just getting a regular 9-to-5, whatever it may be, you know, maybe even, I didn't go so far as going back to being a mechanic again, but, you know, just something different, you know, I could take my skills and work at like a marketing agency, you know what I mean? That doesn't have to do anything with cars, you know? And I looked at a bunch of different things and started getting some smaller marketing gigs, a lot of freelance stuff. And it kind of put me in this mode of like, you know, looking at multiple revenue streams, not just one, you know, not just having, you know, one full-time job that maybe I could look at, like, if it's not paying me enough, it ties me down. Maybe I have multiple freelance things where I put myself in control of my own destiny. And that's really what it did a lot for me. I started just piecemealing work together until I found like I had the right opportunity. And, it's kind of, again, it kind of, you know, fast forward now a couple of years. So during that time frame, 2008-09, it was really rough. I ended up, getting some small gigs. You know, one thing that Amanda and I did and where we ended up meeting a really good friend was, a friend of mine was doing some marketing for Nissan and they were launching, they had, you know, their Z car, you know, the 300ZX, or you've got to remember that Nissan, right? Yeah. And they were coming out with a new one called the 370Z. It's the one that is basically currently out right now. It's been out for like 10 years. So they were launching that. They wanted to do something cool, like where they take a couple cars, the first number one and number two off the assembly line in Japan, bring them over here, bring them around the country, have different like editors of magazines and places drive them to different points. So I organized this tour thing that went around the country. And they needed people to manage it actually on site and go on it. So we did it. We put this price together for them. And it was myself, this guy, Sean Baker, who drove the truck and the rig, and then Amanda, and she documented it because she's a photographer.
Wow.
So we went and did this thing for like a month and drove all around the country. So her and I, you know, we were already toured together. That's how we met each other. But you know, sitting in the same truck for hours and hours is like another story, right? You know what I mean? And then really the dude driving it now, imagine this. So it was a friend of mine, like I said, that had this small marketing agency that got this gig to do some work for Nissan. And again, he pulls me in. Hey man, I need someone. I know you need work. You might want to do this thing. You'll make a block of money, but you're going to be gone for like a month and a half. I'm like, oh, so I look at it and I'm like, well, I'll bring Amanda. She could document it. It says we need a photographer. Boom. Right. So now I don't got to be away from her. So at least that's cool. Right. And then he's like, well, there's going to be this dude. I don't know if you ever met him. His name's Sean Baker. He's going to drive the truck. So you don't have to drive it too, because that's kind of crazy. I'm like, man, but who is this guy? What if me and her don't like him?
Yeah.
He's like, well, what if he don't like you too? You know? So anyways, we end up becoming like family with this guy, my wife and I did. And and he's a graphic artist by trade. Okay. And he's kind of like me. He just did different things. He was in the car show world and stuff like that to get by. And, we met each other on this gig, became great friends. This was in the end of 2008. Okay. So my friend of mine, Christian Radel, that came to me with the opportunity about starting up a Time Attack series in 2010, and he put up the money to do it. And I came up with Global Time Attack and the logo and started putting the whole thing together. I need a graphics guy. So hit up Sean Baker. He lives in Pennsylvania though, right? But you know, the internet's a lot better in 2010. So it's like, Sean, I'm starting this thing. I'm calling it Global Time Attack. I need logo packages. I need like a whole concept. You got to help me out. This is what I want, you know, blah, blah, blah. And he was our guy, man. He was heart and soul of the graphics and the look of GTA from day one up until almost a year ago, dude. He passed away, unfortunately.
Wow.
Younger than us. He just passed away in his sleep one day, dude, just kind of randomly, like had a heart attack or whatever, which really sucked, man. I miss him dearly. I've got someone else doing the graphics now and he's great, but I really miss Sean, man. He knew the deal, you know, sucks. And he was a really good friend. He was someone I would see every year, you know, or twice a year at different big automotive gatherings, you know. We'll be right back.
love what I do. And I'm vested in my team as human beings, not just, you know, people who are providing an end product. You know, there's just a sense of community that everybody needs. Even if it's three or four people, you just accomplish so much more because you have a mission. And the mission is clear in our organization. Our mission in Gazelle is to inspire and uplift and give opportunity to those that will not have other doors open for them for whatever reason. So there's always the underlying thing, that you get to be known for, because you are all in alignment as a group. So I certainly attract like-minded people. I think that helps, you know, because everybody has different values in whatever they're doing. And so aligning with people who think and see the world in a similar way that you do helps a lot in that process. To have people, you know, there's a certain point that you get in your career where people are scared of telling you the truth. Mm-hmm. And I have always wanted to be surrounded with people who are not afraid to tell me when I'm steering wrong. And that has become even more evident as we are dealing with diversity issues. You know, diversity and politics are such great dividers. What is my responsibility with having this platform to be able to impact change? But understanding that every single person, regardless of their opinion and view on the world, is still a human being.
Yes.
You know, and how do you tell the stories responsibly in a way that is uplifting? You know, that takes a bit of strategy and intention. You know, what is your intention for doing it? So that's something I think about when we are covering controversial things. You know, if I just remember that everything that I want to do, I wanted to lift somebody up, then I'm very careful in how I say things, because you realize that people are actually listening. So how am I going to communicate? Because people are listening to me, which means whatever I'm saying has the potential to influence what that person does when interacting with somebody else. So I like fostering a world of understanding. There was a moment in time when I didn't think I'd make it, because I was so set on, you know, talking about being set on your original plan, I had no flexibility to change the plan. My plan was to have a print publication, which the distribution is from Brentwood all the way to Chesterfield and then to Kirkwood, Wildwood, that whole area. That plan was going well. The problem is the world was changing. And I didn't allow myself to accept that the world was changing fast enough in a way that wouldn't impact the bottom line for me. I think we pivoted just in time, and this period of COVID couldn't have been more, you know, the blatantness of how critical it was to move digitally. It's now. Everybody is digital right now. Everybody is virtual. It's an important part. This event has forced everybody to understand the power of digital. So had I made that transition 2 years ago, as opposed to a year ago, we would have certainly gotten bigger rewards. But at the same time, going through that tension, you know, the tension of trying to stick with the same thing, keep it going, and then realizing if we don't change, we're going to drown. It will be the end. The world is changing. We have to change. We pivoted in time so that when COVID happened, it was a seamless transition.
Yes.
You know, so our whole team can function on a digital virtual platform. And not many businesses can say that. Not many media businesses can say that. So I appreciate the foresight to have done it, but I certainly wish I had done it earlier. And if there's something I would tell anybody right now is you cannot be one-dimensional with your business. Things happen unexpectedly.
when you have whatever your job is, I feel like if you do your job well, that can get noticed. So whatever it was, if I was, you know, a good waitress or good at running the club, it's like I feel like people start to notice that. And whether that's demeanor or, you know, I try to, you can be moody, and sometimes it's hard when you're just like, you know, I'm a moody fucking, it's a lot. But the environments that I worked in, it's like you go out and you have to be smiley and you have to be friendly. And I found myself, if I was in a bad mood, I'd go into work and I'd leave in a good mood. Oh. And that was like a really good place to be. So I think there was just, I remember when I was at Stand Up New York, this was Dave Attell walked up to me and he said, he just leaned on the podium and goes, "You seem like a reasonable person. When are you going to get out of here and start managing?" Wow. And I was like, "What?" Like, oh,
Dave Attell says that?
And I remember telling him, I was like, "I don't know anything yet, Dave. Like, I still have to learn stuff." And, but that was really cool. It was just cool seeing people. And you don't know, you know, it's like, I oddly didn't go to a lot of comedy clubs I didn't work at, because I was always working. So I didn't know until a little later in my career as I started going out to shows, I'm like, oh, a lot of people just don't give a fuck. Like a lot of bookers don't care. They don't care about their talent. Like to a lot of people, it is a business. They're not comedy nerds. They saw a market for something and it's business, 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 business. They don't treat their artists well. They don't treat the talent well. They don't treat the staff well. And I'm just like, I never want to be like that. Mm. And so I think that, just that desire, you know, people start. And then also just, I remember when I was doing hair, my friend Tara, every once in a while, she'd be like, "Christine, you play too much." And it was just like where you can kind of be like, you're always like joking around. You're always making a joke. You're always trying to make a joke about something. Now, whether or not it's funny, it's like just always in that mode of like trying to talk shit. And then like being around professional community, like I just always found, I'm like, these people are so easy to talk to. Like I found comics so easy to talk to. I didn't feel like I was in a world where I was like too much or too outspoken or too any of that. And I also found that like the people coming into the clubs, working at the clubs that wanted to be there were good people. And then just the general public that was choosing to spend their time by going to see stand-up comedy, it was like a good group of people that I was around as well. You know, it was like the customers were cool. It was a lot different than like working at a sports bar in Midtown.
Right.
So, you know, a lot of it just, I think doing a good job at the things that I was responsible to do at the time and like just building personal relationships and being able to talk to people, eventually things just kind of start clicking. And then it's been other people like believe, I said, if it were up to me, like I'd just be like crying in a corner, worried about how like everything's going to fuck up and everything's going to fall apart and nothing's going to go well. And it's all going to be a disaster. Luckily, I have like other people, you know, such as my business partners, like Louis J. Gomez and Rebecca Trent, where I'm like, they believe in me. You know, like they believe I can get it done. They believe I can like do what needs to be done. And the same way I trust them. So a lot of my success in my career is really like working with the right people, working with the right people for me, working with people that, you know, have the same goals and have skill sets that I don't have and can like kind of help me find what I'm good at. It really was something. And then the other side of that is like the other worst thing that I can't say is the best thing. We had a terrible tragedy happen in the comedy community last year. And specifically with like me and Jay, my boss that I would say him and his business partners and the guys that run the Stand, Cringe Humor, it's Chris Italia, Paul Italia, Patrick Milligan, and the late Dave Kimowitz, they kind of like plucked me from obscurity. You know, they were kind of the guys that were like, they saw something in me. Like they wanted to hire me to come like open their comedy club and assist them at their management company and all that, just from like producing shows with them at clubs that I manage. So it was really, they were like the first guys who like saw something more in me than like getting them drinks. And, you know, I was hired for the company at the same time Jay was brought on as a client. Like a lot of our relationship has like evolved through that. And this last year there was, you know, Dave was, he was murdered. And it was a horrible, horrible, horrible situation. It was something where I realized like what I was able to do this time that I couldn't do when I was 15, when this like horrible tragedy struck, is I definitely like, I was able to feel it. I was able to cry my eyes out every day, and I was able to go through it without what I knew not to do. Like, I knew that I shouldn't start taking drugs. I knew that I shouldn't start taking anti-anxieties or cocaine or like any of these old crutches that I had used in the past to get through this grief, and instead just like feel the emotions and go through the process. So I'm like, and I attribute a lot of that to dealing with my mother's death and whatever resilience that built in me to be able to take on. And I wouldn't say I dealt with it great. Look, it was still really hard, but I did deal with it. I didn't, and I'm still dealing with it, and we'll see what happens. You know, it's great. I was telling both the tragedies in my life. My mom's death was April of 2001, and then Dave's death was August of 2019, both followed with like global tragedies right afterwards. So it was like my mom's death was followed by 9/11. And then Dave's death was followed by the pandemic.
Yes.
And so it's like, I honestly haven't even, it was almost like God was like, you need to grieve, girl. Like, I'm giving you a break, because we haven't even like dealt with really moving forward what this is going to look like without this like completely influential, you know, important person as a part of our lives anymore. So, you know, those are things where I'm like, I'm not going to say that's, I really feel like it was so senseless and all that. But, you know, I'm grateful for the experience I had with my mother to help me move through something like this. And then also something like this happened. You're like, well, what the fuck could be worse than this now? You're like, hopefully me and all my friends, like, hopefully nobody will experience tragedy. Like hopefully this is the top for us, you know? So, but these, everything does, you know, it's hard. Sometimes you want to go back and you want to change. Oh, I could have done it this way. I could have done it that way. I could have done this. I should have done this. If I had just done that, and I'm like, I don't know, like, I do enjoy my life. And I feel like I've enjoyed my life, my entire adult life. Look, there's been some like bad times and broke times. And obviously, you know, been a goddamn long-term relationship forever. Like, that's a whole new thing. You're like, oh, wow. You're like somebody, you're like, oh my gosh, somebody, I'm connected. But it really was those two, you know, I think one of those ties into the other, and it really was. And I think it's really important to, you know, it gets to a point where you're like, you can only blame your childhood for so long. At a point you're like, well, you've been the driver's seat for a long time, buddy.
Thank you for listening to the Best Worst Thing podcast. I'm your host, Josh Willewa. Music is produced by Josh One. You can follow him at Boom Note on Instagram and Twitter, and Josh One on Spotify. Our episodes are edited by Cool Jets Audio and Visual. You can follow them at Cool Jets AV on Instagram. Our marketing is designed by Francesca Daniels. You can find her at FrankandKitty24 on Instagram. And our overall design is by Inspired Design with Ryan Daniels. You can find them at getinspired.design on Instagram. Thank you for listening to The Best Worst Thing.